KPCW News, time is 8:06. This is the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Well, let's find out what's in store for our weather. On the phone, I have Thomas Giboy with ABC4. Now, Thomas, I had really hoped that we would begin this conversation with a discussion of the upcoming Mississippi State-North Carolina match, but it was just not meant to be, was it, Thomas?
Oh, the pain. I was hoping for that as well, because I thought if we could make it past this first round that we would have a decent chance, but going against Michigan State in the NCAA tournament was always going to prove to be difficult, and unfortunately it was just too much. They got behind the eight ball and just could never recover. But yeah, that I'm still kind of reeling from that one, Roger. I appreciate that
one. All right, so what do we got coming up in the weather as we all sit in front of our TVs watching NCAA basketball this weekend?
Well, so we got March Madness in full swing, and pretty soon we're going to have madness in our very own weather, because it's spring in Utah, and spring in Utah is notorious for seeing ups and downs, and that's exactly what we got coming our way over the next 72 hours. So that's all that to say is that if you've been enjoying the temperatures that we've seen this week, you want to make sure that you get outside and enjoy today. It's beautiful right now in the Wasatch back. It's a little bit chilly, but by this afternoon, we'll see a daytime high in the 50s. We'll also see a little bit more cloud coverage. The wind will start to increase out of the south, and then throughout the course of the afternoon to the early evening, there will be at least a chance for a few spotty showers and even a few rumbles of thunder. And if I had to put a percentage on it in the Wasatch back, roughly a 20 to 30% chance that wet weather finds you. So a better chance than not, but don't be surprised if at some point today that you do find a shower or a thunderstorm. As we go into our Saturday, we see our next cold front move its way in. So the chance for wet weather will be increasing as we go from the morning. The afternoon, we'll still see a daytime high above average, but instead of low 50s like we're going to see today in Park City, we'll be in the upper 40s tomorrow. But once the front moves through, you'll definitely notice it. So what was likely going to start off as potentially rain in Park City could quickly become snow, and we'll be looking at a chance of straight snow showers by Saturday night, with the overnight low falling to 26 degrees. And on Sunday, we're not going to see a daytime high get out of the middle 30s in Park City. We'll see a daytime high come in at 36 degrees, a 90% chance of snow shower sticking around through the day. I should mention that between Saturday and Sunday, we're not going to see nonstop snow, but it likely could come in waves in both Saturday and Sunday, bringing that 90% chance. And even though the cold front moves away between Saturday and Sunday, we're still going to stay unsettled through the first half of next week as we look at a 70% chance of snow showers on Monday, roughly an 80% chance on Tuesday, as daytime highs will be hanging out in the middle 30s between Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, with overnight lows in the low to mid 20s in the Wasatch back. So after our taste of spring, it's going to be feeling like winter once again. We could see things calm down a little bit for Wednesday, all to see things ramp back up by Thursday on what could be another potent storm system set to move in. Temperature will climb a little bit on Wednesday, should be back in the low 40s, all to see the daytime high on Thursday go back to the 30s. But through this weekend in the Wasatch back, there's a chance that most spots could pick up a trace to roughly 3 inches of snow. But in places like Park City, a little bit higher in elevation, around 7,000 feet, there is at least a chance that we could see 6 inches of snow, with definitely more for Park City Mountain and for Deer Valley Resort. So winter's making its way back to the Beehive State here, Roger. So more March madness for us.
All right, Thomas, but before I let you go, you're a man who makes predictions for a living. Let me hear your final four.
My final four. Oh, I'd have to actually pull it up. I have two brackets that I have set. But in my two brackets, I have one bracket I have North Carolina winning, and one bracket Purdue winning. So those are my two champions in the two brackets that I filled out.
All right. Thanks, Thomas, and have a good weekend.
Likewise.
And let's find out what this unsettled weather pattern might mean for the backcountry. On the phone, I have Drew with the Utah Avalanche Center.
Hey, morning. Currently we're at low danger. There's not much going on in the backcountry. I'd probably continue, if you're skiing or riding in the Central Wasatch, I'd probably continue to avoid Stairs Gulch, Broad's Fork, and Big Cottonwood Canyon. That's habitat well known for large and destructive glide release avalanches. But otherwise, generally low danger. Cornices, of course, always tender during periods of warmth and heating. But I get paid to worry. Part of that is just sort of poking holes at what, where things may go awry. And I have to tell you that, during springtime, we like to have a good melt, freeze, diurnal cycle. And I pay attention to upwards of 50 weather stations, and and a couple of weather stations on the, along the Park City Ridge Line in those mid-elevation. They just have not had a very good refreeze since Sunday, Monday. So big picture, if you're out in the backcountry, particularly along the Park City Ridge Line, and you're starting to feel the snow become wet, punchy, unsupportable, call it a day or head to a cooler location or get on the lower angle terrain. But again, that's more the exception, not the rule. So overall, low avalanche danger. And we'll be rising in lockstep with the storm. We'll see how it plays out for tomorrow night into Sunday. But we'll be back into winter for the next week or so.
Does sound like it. Okay, Drew, thanks and have a good weekend.
Yep, thanks.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with Park City Board of Realtors CEO Jamie Johnson about the recent National Association of Realtors settlement. And we're going to finish our hour with a recorded chat with Salt Lake Tribune executive editor Lauren Gustis. Stay tuned. The Park City School District has signed an agreement to resolve a federal discrimination and harassment investigation. And as KPCW's Christine Weller reports, some parents are disappointed with the district's response.
The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights enforces federal laws prohibiting discrimination based on race, color, national origin, sex, and disability. In the spring of 2023, it opened an investigation into 7 harassment complaints filed against the Park City School District. However, over the course of the investigation, the federal agency found more than 180 reported incidents of student-to-student harassment from 2021 to 2023. And the OCR said there could actually be more unknown incidents because of the district's, quote, inconsistent maintenance of relevant records. The incidents were reported at Ecker Hill Middle School, Treasure Mountain Junior High School, and Park City High School. The investigation found the harassment based on protected classes was severe and pervasive enough to create a hostile environment for some students and limit their access to education. Scott Van Hartesveld has a child in the district. He said he was alarmed at the lack of communication he received from schools and the district. He also said Superintendent Jill Gilday's letter outlining steps the district will take was too ambiguous.
The school district needs to understand that they just don't have credibility with parents right now because of the way that this process has gone on, because of the fact that they haven't contextualized any of this stuff.
One parent whose child was a victim of race-based harassment and discrimination spoke to KPCW on the condition of anonymity. They said the district wasn't forthcoming with information even when the harassment was happening. The parents said they were also disappointed the district didn't initially share information from the investigation. The district did post a link to the investigation Thursday. Barry Nan Rothschild also has students in the district. She said they have experienced anti-Semitism at school. She said it took her oldest son months to tell her about harassment from a teacher.
Once action started to be taken, and I will credit the school district with taking action in that instance, lots of other people came out of the woodwork to say, oh, my child witnessed another child being harassed.
Rothschild was also disappointed with how the district communicated with parents about the federal agreement. She expressed frustration that the initial email to parents lacked information about the agreement, only linking to it. After clicking that link, parents would have to click 3 more links to get the information related to the investigation, the agreement, and the full statement from the superintendent.
In terms of the way the report's been handled, I'm really frustrated by it because there has been no real sense of urgency about making sure parents understand what's going on.
Parents KPCW spoke with say they hope the district will be more transparent in disclosing harassment incidents in the future. According to the joint resolution between the Park City School District and the Office for Civil Rights, the district must revise harassment policies and procedures, provide individual remedies for students, and implement a plan to educate students and parents on reporting harassment, among other changes. The OCR will monitor the district's progress until it complies with the terms of the agreement, which is expected to be the summer of 2026. The district has created a landing page on its website with information about the Office of Civil Rights investigation and steps the district will take to come into compliance. The district did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, Utah Governor Spencer Cox recently praised the state's ability to host the Olympics in 2034 and beyond. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Governor Cox said Thursday more countries would be vying to host the Olympics if they were in the same position as Utah.
I promise you that if every country had the infrastructure that we had, they would see it as a smart investment. The reason that some countries have decided not to do it is because they have to build all of these venues, and that's very expensive. And then the venues don't get used, and they end up getting torn down. And that's clearly a waste. We are so fortunate not to have that problem or that issue.
The International Olympic Committee has named Salt Lake City as the preferred host for the Winter Olympics in 2034, but that won't be officially decided until the summer. The IOC has not officially recognized any other host cities for the 2034 Games. The IOC has discussed establishing a rotation of hosts for the Winter Games amid concerns about climate change and declining snowfall. Cox said Utah could be a contender in that cycle.
My hope is, and there's certainly been talk of this, that over the course of the next few years that the IOC will make a decision to kind of have a set group of cities that host the Olympics so that every 20 years, maybe, or every 16, we come back to these host cities and that Salt Lake City will be one of those. I could envision one where you have an Asian Winter Games, a European Winter Games, a North American Winter Games.
The governor said he hopes to be in Paris this summer when the IOC is expected to award the 2034 Olympics on Pioneer Day, or July 24th. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Everyone's invited to a local artist marketplace Friday and Saturday to see latest works by local artists. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Spring into Art will showcase the work of 30 artists. It's the first time the Park City Artists Association has planned such an event. Artist and organizer Karen Kendall says they're grateful the hotel could accommodate all of the creators who wanted to participate.
We've been trying to find various ways for local artists to be able to show and exhibit and sell their art from a grassroots basis, you know, trying to get us out there. So this was a big deal for us. It's the first show we've ever done, and we're really pleased with the way that it's coming around.
Artists will run the gamut from painters to photographers, ceramicists to jewelers, as well as both steel and glass sculptors. The Arts Council just opened the new Create PC Marketplace on Kearns Boulevard. While it's the only permanent location for local artists to exhibit their work, size constraints only allow an artist to display just a few pieces. Getting accepted into the Kimball Arts Festival or a local gallery, they say, is very difficult to do.
We want to make sure that any artists that are interested have the opportunity to get as much exposure as possible, right? And so having this show is just giving people one more forum to be able to sell their art.
The art show is at the DoubleTree by Hilton Friday from 3 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6. Admission and parking are free. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
A free weekly program at the PC Mark brings people of all abilities together to walk, talk, and discover their superpowers. KPCW's Amber Johnson has more.
You've probably seen C.J. Herriter around town at Lucky One's Coffee or the pool. Known by some as Park City's unofficial mayor, this 21-year-old with Down syndrome works hard and plays hard. Division manager Heather Todd said the Mark tries to create an integral workplace for all abilities. CJ has been a beloved fixture in the aquatics program for several seasons. 2 years ago, the staff started exploring ways to work with him in the wintertime.
He came up with this walk and talk where he could write up questions as icebreaker questions and walk the track with friends. And it could be for anybody to come inside, someone just to have a community.
Walk and talk with CJ is every Monday at 2 p.m. through mid-May. The group leisurely loops the track 7 times, covering about a mile. CJ said you don't have to be a member of the Mark to attend.
It's so much fun at my walk talk. It's so much fun at best talk to everyone, and that's it.
CJ not only walks the talk, he has great taste in public radio stations.
I love to say I love KPCW because they are awesome people the whole time.
Most of the walkers are from the Park City Learning Center's transition class, where young adults 18 to 22 of all abilities learn about employment, continuing education, and independent living while also honing their social skills. CJ's icebreakers provoke lots of laughter, and some answers are more controversial than others, like his classmate Taylor's least favorite food.
My favorite food is hamburgers. My least favorite is mac and cheese.
What?
You don't like mac and cheese?
Yes.
During our walk, CJ also asked the group what superpower they wanted. This time, Taylor's answer was spot on.
Probably have a happy power to give people for happiness.
And if you spend time walking and talking with CJ and company, you'll quickly learn that superpower has already been granted. Amber Johnson, KPCW News.
Park City Mountain owner Vail Resorts recently published data from its annual investors conference. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has a rare peek into the company that often keeps numbers private.
Vail Resorts showed investors Epic Pass sales have increased 95% since 2020, nearly doubling from 1.2 million to 2.4 million in the last 4 years. About 80% of that increase was people buying passes for the first time. This season, 75% of visits are pass holders, the highest figure Vail has ever recorded. It's long been the company's strategy to push customers to buy passes over walk-up lift tickets because the company gets advanced revenue before winter begins, making it less weather dependent. According to Vail's internal data, Park City Mountain ranked fourth in its portfolio for the most visits last season, behind Breckenridge, Whistler Blackcomb, and Vail Beaver Creek. A link to the full report with insight into the company's staffing and expansion priorities can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
So police in Heber said they don't have any leads after vandals were caught on camera stealing pride flags around town. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Heber police are investigating three separate cases as of March 14th. A rainbow sidewalk at Encircle, a safe space for LGBTQ youth in Heber, was spray painted black, and homeowners caught masked individuals on camera as they ripped down residents' pride flags. One made what appeared to be a Nazi salute. Heber Police Sergeant Josh Weishar says video of the vandalism at Encircle hasn't yielded any suspects.
The video from the spray paint case is so grainy that there's no way to identify who was spray painting the concrete.
He says in the doorbell camera footage, the individuals' masks make them difficult to identify. The officer in charge of investigating these cases said she has no progress to report as of Wednesday night. Meanwhile, the incidents have sparked strong reactions in the community. Resident Angie Kennard says her family was shocked when they saw their transgender pride flag had been stolen overnight. She says they'll press charges when or if the perpetrators are identified.
It's not just kids being kids, it's hate being taught.
She says while they haven't had flags stolen before, the incident is hardly the only instance of transphobia her family has encountered while living in Heber. Kennard says the environment can be challenging for her son, who's transgender, and for other LGBTQ kids in town.
That's all they want to do is be themselves and live their life. They're just trying to exist in a really ugly world that does not want them to exist.
Pride flags have a charged history in Heber. The city council effectively banned pride flags on Main Street in 2020, a year after rainbow banners that read Pride in the Wasatch Back sparked significant backlash. Now, street banners are restricted to federal and state holidays and must be deemed non-political. And Kennard says other residents have reached out to her with similar stories about when their pride flags were stolen. Nevertheless, she says the incident won't stop her family from showing support for LGBTQ rights.
We're obviously going to put up another flag just because it's not even for him. It's for other kids that are in a situation that they don't have parents that accept them for who they are.
She says they already have a new trans pride flag to replace the stolen one, and this time they'll hang it higher than ever. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Last week, the National Association of Realtors entered into a historic settlement paying some $418 million to resolve a national class action alleging that the NAR has engaged in anti-competitive practices with respect to the payment of buyer broker fees. In addition to the payment, the NAR has agreed to revise its practices in several ways. Here to help us understand the settlement from the realtors' perspective is Park City Board of Realtors CEO Jamie Johnson. Morning, Jamie. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Jamie, let's start with the big picture. What was the basis of the lawsuit, and why did the NAR choose to settle it?
So the national claim was brought in a class action lawsuit by home sellers concerning the MLS Cooperative Compensation Model Rule, which in the past was in the model rules of the National Association requiring a number to be put into the MLS for an offer of compensation. Now, the way that that could be interpreted is that there would be any number put into that line item for the broker compensation agreement. That number could have been zero. That number could have been two, three, four. It was an option for brokerages to be able to work together so that the agent on the buyer side and the agent on the seller side would be compensated for their work. So with that, the litigation came basically saying that there was some type of collusion or steering because of that model, which we as the association and the MLS would say is wrong. That is not the way that the MLS rule was interpreted or read or even used within the MLS. And it was just a way for the brokerages to offer compensation. It was never a set figure. It was never a demanded or not negotiable figure. And so that is when this lawsuit came forward. Obviously, the National Association lost. And so we went into the settlement agreement as of last Thursday evening.
So let's take a step back. We're doing a little bit of inside baseball here. When we're talking about a number, I think what we're talking about is that the requirement was that for something to be listed on the MLS, there had to be a specific number included that would represent the proposed compensation to the buyer's agent.
Correct.
I got that right?
Yes. Okay.
So
the
that's
offer of compensation to the representative that would be bringing a buyer for that listing.
And as you understand it, what was the theory that the plaintiffs claimed rendered this anti-competitive?
That it was a set figure. So if you've heard the news over the last week, a lot of people have been throwing around a certain number, figure, percentage that was saying that it was a standard across the industry, that it was a set and not able to be negotiated number, which again is not true. Every association and MLS in the country, we train on antitrust and not setting, fixing, or pegging prices or commissions. I mean, that is who we are and what we do and what we've always done. But in this instance, the attorneys were saying that the sellers were steered towards a certain percentage and not able to negotiate that.
And I haven't seen the evidence, but my guess is there was probably some evidence that they probably adduced to show that the number tended to coalesce around specific figures. In other words, as a factual matter, they would probably argue with you when we say that the rules from the Realty Association was not to have it be a set figure. They would probably argue that as a practical matter, it did tend to almost asymptotically approach a fixed level.
I would guess that that was their approach. I was obviously not in the courtroom.
And we may try to get someone who was more actively involved in the litigation to discuss it in a future broadcast. As you understand it, why did the association choose to settle the case?
Absolutely. You know, they had really three options. And the first option was an appeal, which was considered and looked at. But with an appeal, the association would have had to post or serve secure, I should say, a $5 billion bond.
We're hearing a lot about securing bonds these days.
Right.
Anyway.
So they would have had to do that. And with that, they did not have the financial resources to do it. Therefore, they would have had to file for bankruptcy, which was option number two. And they did not see that as an option. They did not want to do that to the association that has done so much for the industry for so many years and not to the members who have supported it. So it was an option, but not really. And then the third was settlement. And settlement was discussed throughout the trial. So prior to going into the trial, during the trial, and then, of course, now after the trial. So settlement actually helped cover boards and released the boards and associations, MLSs across the country that were owned by the association. So if the MLS, the multiple listing service, is owned by the association, then they are covered under this release of liability for this litigation nationwide.
Now, is the local MLS owned by the association?
Ours is,
so correct. It will be included in that release?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How will the settlement change the way that homes are listed in the MLS?
Absolutely. It's not going to change the way they're listed. It's just going to remove the offer of compensation from the MLS. So that is the major change, is that they are removing the rule or removing the requirement to put in some type of offer of compensation. So there will no longer, through the MLS, be this offer between brokerages, again, which was an amazing model for agents and brokerages to understand what they were coming into as they were looking at properties. But now that won't be available. I had people call me Friday morning and say, oh, does this mean I never have to pay a commission again? No, that is not the case. It does not prevent agents or brokerages from receiving commissions. It just changes the way that they go about getting that. And it will also require agents to have a buyer's representation agreement signed prior to them starting to show property to their clients in the community. So it's a little bit more paperwork. But the thing is that I think is good about this is that it will really require agents to sit down and make sure that their buyer and their sellers through the process understand the services and value that are available to them by using a realtor.
So buyer's agents will still be able to receive compensation. It just will not be part of the underlying listing in the MLS. One of the issues that keeps coming up in the press discussion of this was a concern that the existing system would cause something called buyer steering. In other words, that while an individual who is a buyer has a relationship with an agent that is, as I understand it, got some fiduciary obligations, nonetheless, the agent would look at the compensation associated with a particular property, and if it was low, they would say, maybe I won't show my buyer that one. I'll show them the one where I can get the full 3% because that goes into my pocket. Was that a real problem, and will the settlement affect that?
I would say I know for our market here, and I came from the Nashville market prior to being here, that was never an issue. The agents that I worked with, the agents in my association, I believe are truly here for their consumers. You know, I'm a former realtor. I sold 20 years ago, and never once did I scroll down in the listing to see what the offer of compensation was, if it met the needs and the requirements and the desires of my buyer. You want to meet their needs. That's why these people are in this industry. It's they enjoy the opportunity to help people achieve home ownership and to find what they want and what they need. And so I don't think that it was truly an issue, especially in our market here. And I think now it's going to be a little bit more difficult because, you know, the agents are going to have to navigate who will cooperate and who won't and how they will go about finding the information that they need for that purpose. Again, I think and believe that our people are good and that they want to do the right thing for their clients and consumers. And so I am very hopeful that it will lead for cooperation, obviously, outside the MLS.
So the big change is this listing of the fact that no longer will buyer agent compensation be listed in the MLS. Are there other significant changes as a result of the settlement, Jamie?
There are. There's a long list, and you can find out all the information you would like to know at competition.realtor is one website. And then there's also, concerning the settlement and litigation, specifically a website called facts.realtor, where you can go and you can get all of the information. There's a frequently asked questions piece there that if you have specific questions about the settlement or the litigation that you can find more information. I will say though that it will require agents, you know, used to someone would be able to just call you up and say, hey, I want to go see XYZ property. Now they will have to sit down with them, make sure they understand their services and what that would cost them if they were to enter into an agreement and have that written agreement prior to going to show the property. Again, the settlement is still subject to court approval, so we're waiting. Our legal counsel from the National Association said that could take up to a couple of months, but the projection is that in mid-July, this all could go into effect, and at that point, we will begin to and continue to educate our members on what the steps and processes are. I believe that there will be some new forms that attorneys will create that will have to be signed and put into part of the contract as they go forward. But again, it's a disruptor, and we've had many disruptors in our industry over my long term of working in the real estate industry. And I don't believe that it's something that's going to stop people from buying and selling homes and using an expert.
Now, in the press, there's a lot of commentators that are claiming that the settlement is going to lead to some major changes in the total transaction costs associated with real estate transactions. And some contend that this is going to be the beginning of an end of an industry practice that, as a practical matter, has caused real estate commissions to be between 5% and 6%, that this is really going to disrupt that model. What's your take on that?
It could. Okay. I could change, obviously, the way and the amounts that maybe agents made in the past. But if you think about it, if you go to see an attorney and you have a family matter or a business matter, and you go in to see an attorney, the attorney is going to tell you how much they're going to charge you per hour. They're going to tell you what your estimated costs are, and you're going to know that up front. I think that that is where it's just changing our industry, that we will have to make sure that the consumer understands the value and the resources and services that are going to be provided to them. And then, dependent upon that agent, they will be able to set that percentage of what they see their value being. And so I don't know that it's not going to go away. I don't know that the percentage, again, was never set in this market, and especially in our market where we have very large listings, and compensation was not always at that level of what they're saying this industry standard was because of the price point of where we were. So if you had a $30 million property up in the Colony, that agent was not typically getting that larger percentage. They were getting a smaller percentage, but obviously still making a good income. Again, it goes back to the value of the person that is working for you and the service that they are going to provide.
And so as a practical matter, I take it you would not expect things to change all that substantially here in the Park City market.
Not here in the Park City market. I believe that we have an amazing community of realtors who have worked together for a long time. We obviously have a lot of newer agents, but they're going to learn in a new era, right? So they're going to learn the way that it's going to be done now. And the older agents that have been here for a long time have been selling their value to amazing people that come to this community from all over the world for many, many years. And that's not going to change. And the services that they provide are not going to change. I hope it escalates it, actually.
Escalates.
The service and the selling their value to their consumers.
Showing the value that they're getting.
Yeah.
Okay, Jamie, it's springtime in Park City. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the market generally. What are your prospects for the real estate market? What do you think is going to happen this summer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, we chatted briefly before that there is this potential that maybe people would wait to see what's going to happen with the settlement prior to listing or buying a property, just to see. But again, I would go to consumers hopefully understanding what they are getting and knowing that it's still a great time to list or sell here in the Park City area, as inventory is a little better than it has been over the past couple of years. But because there is a limited inventory, the buyers have less to choose from. And so if you list now, you may have a better chance for an offer.
You know, there are multiple markets here in Park City, and some are going to be more sort of sensitive to things like interest rates than others. I mean, some of the high-end properties are more likely to be cash buyers, and they're probably more sensitive to the Dow Jones than to the interest rates. But both of those phenomenon are sort of trending positive. You have the Fed last week saying that they're going to cut interest rates, three times this year. You have the Dow and the S&P hitting new highs. Does that bode well for sort of an increase in volume here in the Park City area over the next few months?
Yes, I believe in the Park City area and across the country. Our national economist, Lawrence Yoon, was speaking to association executives last week at our conference in San Diego, and he showed a chart that showed that at the end of 2024, that the continuation of home sales would increase, and also through 2025. And part of that is due to the interest rates. But like you said, there are many people that come here that don't need or don't care so much about the change of the interest rate on a mortgage because they are cash buyers. So again, our market is amazing in that even in the downturn of 2008, 2009, we stayed pretty steady. And I think we will continue to do that and continue to move upward because of the new development and everything that is coming around our community.
There is a lot of new development going on. Can you talk a little bit about, the number of units that are going to be brought into the area in the next 5 years? And it seems like an awful lot to absorb.
It's a lot. I'm not going to lie. There is a lot that has been pre-approved, and many of these developments were approved 20 years ago. If you've ever, what great person you might want to have on at some point is Bill Coleman or Matt Magnata. They have charts, they have maps, they have so much information about what has happened here in the last 20 years and what is going to continue to happen for the next 20 years. And so, yes, we have lots of development around the Jordanelle Basin. We have lots of development going out into the Heber Valley. And I think we're going to see more going up into the Colville area. So again, it's continuing to grow. And I think that that is going to be a challenge for our municipal leaders to figure out how we mitigate and help our community in that growth period.
You know, and people are already talking about the potential impact of another Olympics. Again, looking back to 2002, I think that that did have a remarkable impact on the sort of perception of this as a desirable community and the associated real estate prices. As we do the run-up to 2034, do you think we're going to see, again, assuming that we do get the nod, do you think we're again going to see heightened interest in this community?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a beautiful place to live, work, and play. And as more people come to experience that, they're going to want to be here. And so I think that development is going to sell quickly. I think the new product that's coming on the market is what's selling the fastest right now. A lot of people don't want a project anymore. Back, 10 years ago, people were always looking for something that would be their little DIY project and they could make it their own. But nowadays, it's very much that people want that new product. So I believe that we are going to see that it's just going to continue to improve.
Okay. Jamie, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I don't think so. I really appreciate the opportunity to come in because, again, I do feel as though I woke up Saturday, Sunday, Monday morning watching my morning show, my national morning show, I should say, and heard stats and information that was, I felt like misinformation to consumers. And so for us to be able to talk about the things that we do and what we believe and that we don't believe that this, and again, NAR still is not admitting fault by any means. The settlement does not mean that. It just means that they were trying to protect their members. And so I believe that we have an amazing industry, we provide amazing service, and we believe in our communities, and we will continue to do that.
Jamie, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. Speaking of the Olympics, Park City and Summit County officials will get an update on potential Olympic plans and discuss regional transportation at a joint meeting Friday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
The Park City and Summit County Councils will convene at the Marsack Building Friday for a joint meeting at 9 a.m., Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation President and CEO Colin Hilton is scheduled to share an update about the 2034 Winter Games bid. A delegation from the International Olympic Committee will visit Park City next month ahead of an election to award the Games this summer. The two councils will then move to discuss transportation matters. Officials will learn the results of a study analyzing the best places for regional park and ride lots used to bus visitors and workers to ski resorts and Main Street. They will also get new information on the Utah Department of Transportation's plans to reconstruct the I-80 Kimball Junction interchange. No public comment is scheduled. The full agenda and a link to attend the meeting virtually can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Once a month, we are lucky to have Salt Lake Tribune Executive Editor Lauren Gustis join us to talk about what's new in the news. So, a lot of stuff's been happening over the last few weeks. Let's start with a story I found particularly interesting, this notion that Utah Senator Mike Lee is being considered as a potential attorney general in a new Trump administration, should that occur.
Yeah, so if you follow Senator Mike Lee, some people might like him, some people might not, on Twitter, you kind of see he continues to criticize certainly the Biden administration and lift up policies, practices, proposals that former President Donald Trump is interested in and is very much a friend, I would say, of the organization on social. And I think a lot of people here in Utah have wondered why. They've asked, certainly asked us at the Tribune, why Mike Lee continues to so robustly speak out as, let's say, a critic of the federal prosecutions against Trump for illegally retaining those classified documents, right, and after the 2020 election loss and many, many other things. And I think we now may have at least a partial answer in that, you know, Lee is angling for a position in the Trump administration if Trump is elected president in 2024. Bloomberg earlier this week reported that people familiar with the matter say that Trump is considering either Lee or Texas Senator Ted Cruz to fill the top spot at the Department of Justice, right? That's the Attorney General. If Trump is returning to the White House, is indeed to return to the White House after the 2024 election.
And it would be particularly interesting. I know that Lee's father served as the Solicitor General of the United States during the Reagan administration, but Lee took some pretty interesting positions with respect to the alternate electors scheme that was going on during the period over the transition. And he also he also, I believe, led a campaign to try to keep Trump from getting the nomination in 2016. You sort of have to wonder what changed.
Yeah, he did come out as an early critic of Trump, but then reversed his position. We famously reported that he was texting the White House. He was texting, I believe it was Mark Meadows, saying, tell me what I should be saying. I'm working 16 hours a day. This was immediately after Trump lost the election in 2020, saying, hey, like, tell me what to say. I want to, like, help Trump, and how do I do it? Lee has had aspirations at the Supreme Court level. Our reporter Brian Schott has also reported that out. So I think what's changed is he really is his eye on some of these top legal jobs, quote unquote, in the country.
Yeah, I think Lee was on the short list that Trump released prior to the 2016 election of potential Supreme Court justices. So maybe that's what he wants. Anyway, so... Mm-hmm. Another interesting political figure showed up in Utah, Tommy Tuberville. And what he had to say about where the country was going was, shall we say, colorful.
Yeah, so we just talked about Lee. As most people know, he's one of two senators that serve the state of Utah. The other is Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney has announced he's not going to run for re-election this year. And so there's a bunch of Utahns who have jumped into the fray. And one of them is a guy named Trent Staggs. And Tommy Tuberville, who's an Alabama Republican, came to Utah for a fundraiser for Staggs earlier this week. Again, reporter Brian Schott covered it. And he had some pretty interesting things to say. He said that we are, quote, losing our kids to a satanic cult, and that the 2024 election will not be about Republicans versus Democrats, but anti-Americans versus Americans. We have lost our moral values. We have to get back to the Constitution, which, by the way, he held up as he was speaking and ironically was holding it upside down as he was speaking. We've got to get God back into our country. You know, there is not one Democrat that can tell you that they stand up for God. So it's pretty inflammatory rhetoric at this rally for, again, the candidate, Trent Staggs, who's looking to take Mitt Romney's seat when the election comes around in November.
What kind of reception was he getting?
People liked it. You know, he certainly didn't get booed. We followed up with him after, you know, and said, like, hey, do you, you know, satanic cult, were you sure about that? And, you know, he did not back down. You know, Staggs is trying to position himself as the most pro-Donald Trump candidate in the race. And that's aligned him with people like Tuberville. Tuberville, after speaking in Utah, went down to Arizona to stump for Carrie Lake. You know, I think, you know, this crew is similarly aligned.
And how many active candidates are there on the Republican side to try to get the nomination to replace Mitt Romney?
Oh, you know what? That's a good question. I think at last check there were 11, but don't quote me on that. We've got a primary here in Utah, and then obviously we've got the general. So most of these candidates are angling for that June 27th primary, and they obviously need to win there to move on to November.
We're seeing a lot of money being spent already, much of it by political action committees, to support various candidates. At this point, who do you think are the favorites to try to get that nomination?
That's a good question. A lot of TV ads, I'm not sure if you've seen them. Former Speaker of the House, Brad Wilson, is a favorite, I think, here. You've got John Curtis, I believe, who's got name recognition. So I would put, you know, the couple of them up the top of the list at this point.
Okay. Another story that was interesting in the paper in the last couple of weeks relates to the concept of additional battery power for a large solar power installation. Mm. Where is that, and why is it significant?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So, as you know, many people are interested in solar, but solar, you know, loses its quote-unquote edge when the sun goes down, right? What do we do when we're unable to harvest, you know, the sun because there is no sun to harvest? So there's a company, it's called R Plus Energies, and it's run by the real estate development group, the Gardner Group. That's Kem Gardner's group, right? And his son is heavily involved in this project. They're building something called the Green River Energy Center, and it's down in Emory County. And it's mostly so far been about solar. However, it announced this week that it's going to quadruple the amount of lithium batteries at the site. And what will those batteries do? They'll enable the company to store more energy from the panels and dispatch it in the middle of the night. So we're kind of solving for that sunset problem, if you will, with this array of batteries.
And I think that's the kind of thing that you're going to have to see on a more widespread basis. It's going to be up to some way to really retain the energy if solar power is really going to make the kind of dent in energy consumption that everyone hopes it will.
Yeah, and this company's got some promising investments, right? The price tag for this Green River project is about $1 billion. It's backed by some energy-based investment back east. It's called Sandbrook Capital. That's invested all over the world. The other thing it has going for it is that it's already got an agreement, as I understand it, with Rocky Mountain Power. And as you know, Rocky Mountain Power serves 80% of Utahns, right? So it's helpful, right, that you've got both the investment on the front end and then the output on the back end, the place to serve that power, so to speak.
Okay. Staying on the concept of sort of energy and climate, you ran another interesting story about Utah being and where it ranked in terms of carbon usage. So where do we stack up?
Yeah, we're not so good at that. This is just a fun, you know, data-oriented story. But, you know, when you look at per capita, the amount of carbon that in the average Utahn is using, if you will, what our footprint is, you know, we ranked 29th among all states in 2021. If you look at our per capita basis, so that's the whole state, we're at 19th. But on average, just kind of blew my mind, each person in Utah generates more than 18 tons of carbon dioxide each year. And that's about 3.5 tons more than the average American.
And I guess, so this is an informational story. There's really no sort of proactive thing to go from there, right?
Precisely,
But there was another story that does have a kind of a prophylactic or potential behavioral change, and that was this notion about food and how, how it affects the water supply in the Colorado River.
This story was really interesting. So was the response to this story when we shared it in, you know, the communities that follow the Tribune online. So Instagram, Twitter, IEX, and so on and so forth. And people got really upset. So here's the gist of the story. Utah is doing a decent job of conserving water on a person-by-person basis, right? Like we found a way to conserve at the local level, right? So maybe it's, you know, smart toilets, maybe it's, you flipped your strip and you're no longer watering your lawn. But where we haven't made a lot of progress is in the agricultural sector. And we are growing more alfalfa, over the period of this survey, which was conducted in 2022, than we have in the past. So we're growing about 11% more alfalfa in Utah than we did previously. And we're growing it down south in addition to up north, and that's impacting the Colorado River Basin, right? In addition to, we know, the Great Salt Lake issues that we have. And the reason is because Americans are consuming more dairy. Not necessarily meat, but dairy. And not necessarily milk, but cheese. So apparently we really like cheese. And so the recommendation that this researcher makes is, hey, what if you ate less meat and less cheese? And we propose that. And go ahead. Yeah,
I was going to say, and I can imagine the reaction if there was a suggestion that you eat less meat and less cheese and stop cooking it on a gas stove. But no, less meat and less cheese. And did you get that kind of reaction?
Governor Cox
tweeted or X'd the tweet and said, no thanks, I'm out. And that was a tame response. Yeah. You know, I think, and your listeners may know he's got an alfalfa farm down in San Pete County. But, you know, yes, there was a strong response to this recommendation that we consume less cheese and less meat.
Okay. Lauren, thanks for spending time with us, and we look forward to chatting again next month. An employee of the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office has been arrested for alleged sex crimes involving a minor. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
Investigators with the Utah Attorney General's office arrested Mitchell McKee Monday and booked him into the Davis County Jail in Farmington. McKee works at the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office as Administrative Services Director. His responsibilities involve overseeing three employees, along with setting appointments, processing citizen requests, and other office-related duties. The Wasatch County Sheriff's Office said it was unaware of the allegations involving McKee until the arrest. Their statement said, quote, "The severity and seriousness of the alleged offenses cannot be overstated. McKee has been suspended pending the results of a formal investigation." Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
So coming up this Monday on Mountain Money, we'll get a chance to talk with Pete Cadella. He's with the One Utah Summit. Pete's going to outline how Utah business leaders will connect at the Grand America Hotel on April 11th to 12th, 2024. All this and more on Mountain Money, Monday morning at 9 o'clock, only here on KPCW. Reminder, you can get all the local news in your email every day. Subscribe to The Local at kpcw.org.